amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show, brought to you in association with Trading 212. If you'd like to start investing using the broker that we trust with our stocks and shares, ISAs, there's a link down below to get you started. Use the code FTSE to get yourself a free share. We're also affiliated with finchat.io, which is a great source of information both Steve and I use in putting together our notes for this show. If you'd like to check it out, there's a link down below. If you use that, you can have 15% off any of the pro services. But my name's Steve W, and this week, shares in JD Weatherspoon got a boost as the company announced up to 35 pub closures. Sweetgreen shares jumped 42% on the news it's going to try and make some things that are actually nice. And Jim Simons, the man who solved Wall Street, died today at age of 86. One of the best to ever do it. If you'd invested 100 quid with him, you'd have over 400 million, 30 years later. That's 66% per year. I would love 1 year at 66%. Don't know about you, Steve. But we don't have much time to talk about any of those things. There are so many other things going on. And to discuss them, I am joined by Steve D. How are you, Steve, and how has your week been?
Yeah, just a quick note on Jim Simon, Steve, before we move on. The greatest to ever do it, better than Buffett, better than Lynch, but probably not as widely sort of known because he was a quant, really, a mathematical genius who surrounded himself with other mathematical geniuses, and it was just not a sexy way of investing. But yeah, 66% per year, and that's before his fee, Steve, which I said to you, I remember at the end we're in the 40%, but even if you got 40%, you're still getting, you know, an average of 30-odd% returns, which, you know, you would take. I've got Jim Simon's five principles for you, Steve. I'll quickly rattle through these, but his five principles were: be guided by beauty, just as a great theorem can be very beautiful. A company that's really working very well and very efficiently, that can also be beautiful. To surround yourself with the smartest and best people you can possibly can, let them do their thing. Don't sit on top of them. If they're smarter than you, all the better. Steve, this is what you need to learn with. You need to ditch me as soon as possible.
I thought that was to do with the being surrounded by beauty thing that you were worrying about there, but okay.
Do something original. Don't run with the pack. And if everybody's trying to solve the same problem, don't do that. To not give up easily, to stick with it. Stick with it not forever, but really give it a chance to get where you're going. And the final principle was to hope for good luck. And he said that was the most important principle. So yeah, rest in peace to Jim Simons. One of the best.
Yeah, whenever the market goes down, he makes 100-something% in a year. That by itself would do, but also impressive returns when things went well. Yeah, one of the best in the business. Buffett says the first rule is don't lose money. He didn't lose money, but he did plenty more than that as well. How's your week been, Steve?
Yeah, not too bad, Steve. It's been fairly busy. I had yesterday afternoon off because I got a couple of dates mixed up, and it's actually next week I need off. So rather than cancel it, I just thought, well, I'll just have it. And I ended up coming home. There was nobody here. So I just sort of sat in my chair and messed about on my phone and started reading a book. And yeah, all well, Steve. It's a strange thing. But, you know, a little bit of free time was really nice. Had a decent week in stocks as well. I'm just going to look now, 1.38. We're still open as we record this. So 1.38% on the week. In terms of stocks that have had a decent week for me, Carver's nearly at 9% again, Adyen 8%, Zenda 6.29%, and then maybe some surprising ones, Forterra 4.64%, Southern Copper 4%, and then we're getting into the threes and ones and some that are barely even. Fortinet, Doc Martens, Enphase, Disney and Progeny are my only reds. Enphase down just under 5%, Disney just under 7%. And Progeny was down 30-odd% in first, but now it's only about 12%. And that was actually my first ever out of hours buy, Steve. I ticked that box and I bought the stock when it fell down in after hours to $21. I thought that felt like a real gift there. Looking at these earnings, I think there's a short-term pain, long-term gain kind of thing going on. And Jim Simons shone on me today, Steve, because it's already 28 or maybe 27 as we talk now. So yeah, got a little bit back on that already. How's your week, Steve, been? And how's your week in stocks been?
My week in general has been sort of the opposite of yours. It's been absolute chaos, to be honest. There's so much going on. Work is extremely busy at the moment, and it really feels like it's been a few late nights, early mornings, and trying to get stuff done. Also, my mother-in-law has broken her shoulder, which is unfortunate for any number of reasons for her, but it also means that we're a day short on childcare. So I'm trying to fill that in with a bit of wriggling work around and trying to push things into other spaces, which makes the other days quite congested if I end up taking that out. Markets-wise, broadly similar to you. I had a look at about 3:30 earlier. It's now sort of 8:30 at what the kind of major indices have done over the last week and my portfolio. Then, so it is about sort of 5 hours ago that I checked, but close enough. Like you, I'm sort of between most of them. I am above the S&P, which is up by 1% and a bit, below the FTSE 100, which is up by 3% and keeps banging into new highs here. And also below the global thing, which is presumably being dragged higher by not the US part of it, which is quite an impressive effort for something to kind of tow that higher, given the amount of exposure there is to the US in there. But that's quite impressive. I was going to ask whether you thought your out-of-hours transaction that Trading 212 had kindly facilitated for you would therefore mean that you made more money now. All of a sudden, it looks like kind of almost immediately the answer is yes. If you'd hung around waiting for that, you might not have got the same prices. Looking like a good move. I also had an out-of-hours transaction this week, I should say. Southern Copper, that both of us own, sent out a dividend in the form of stock. That turned my ISA into a fractional. And I thought a couple of things. One is that I wouldn't have reinvested that dividend if I'd been given it in cash. To be honest, I would have looked somewhere else with it. And the second is that it required me to look at an ugly fractional share in my ISA. One thing, so I sold it and I put it somewhere else. But one thing it did kind of get me thinking back to is how far Trading 212 has come in the last, we haven't been doing this that long, 3 or so years. It doesn't feel like that long ago that their system would have been, we have to sell you this and give you the cash in a spin out or anything like that, dividend like this. They would have said, can't process this. We're going to have to, you can buy it if you want, but we're going to have to sell the things and give you the cash for it. And we'll work out how much to give you. Moved a long way from that, right? They're now at the point of able to kind of handle dividends in stock and just add them onto your account, which is very nice. Even if I did immediately go and sell it again and turn the thing back into cash, but that's on Southern Copper, not on that.
Yeah, I did the same thing. So I converted mine pretty much straight into cash and had a quick conversation with you afterwards about, you know, maybe this being the right time to exit Southern Copper as a whole as well. Up nearly, I think, 240% in it now. But it's one of those things that the bull case in copper is so straightforward, really, in that the you know, especially when you've got what you feel is probably the best supplier in the game with the best mines and the best cost of production, and the demand for copper is very, very strong. It might feel like the right time to sell Southern Copper, but it almost certainly isn't. So I didn't sell it in the end. I have held on to it. But on to your other point, Steve, about complexity. Trading 212 is doing a fantastic job of being able to handle the sort of complexity of the market. It's become a really, really impressive outfit, which is, you know, when we reached out to them to sponsor us, and they agreed, we was over the moon with that, Steve. And the service is only getting better. This week they've announced that they're going to be launching a cash ISA that's coming, we think, at the end of this month. And it's going to be a pretty straightforward offering. It's going to be 5.2% APY, so that's a variable rate, but paid daily like it is in your stocks and shares ISA. You'll be able to withdraw at any time. There's no account fees. there's no minimum amounts, and obviously you still get your 85,000 FSCS protection that you would get, you know, with any other sort of bank related account. The other thing they've announced, Steve, that comes with it is that they're making this account flexible as well. So it's going to be a flexible ISA. So if that's a new term for anybody at home, that essentially, I'll pass to Steve for that. But the one last bit I did want to just sort of cover before we go over flexible ISAs, that if one of your worries about holding cash in the account was that you didn't want your money to be in a QMMF and into the qualified money market fund, well, a cash ISA cannot be invested into a QMMF. So you could put your money into the cash ISA and that will just be stored in banks and you will have none of the sort of worry of a QMMF going bust, even though we've previously gone over how good these qualified money market funds. I think the one that they're in at the moment has only ever dropped 0.2% twice in a day since its inception. So, and that was a long time ago. So these things are steady and generate a good return. They're actually generating in excess of 5.2% at the moment, which is why it's a good vehicle for trading 212. Last time I checked, it was near 5.36%. So there's a little bit in there for trading 212 to palm off. But Steve, what's a flexible ISA?
A flexible ISA is basically one that allows you to take your money out of it and put it back in again in the same tax year. So if you deposit your full 20,000 contribution limit on April the 6th, which you can do, into your cash ISA, and then decide suddenly that actually you didn't really mean to do that, or you need the cash, or actually you wish you'd put it somewhere else for the time being, you can take some of it or all of it back out again. And then you can put it back in later in on in the year if you change your mind or your situation changes or you just earn some more money and become in a position to put that back. So where previously, if you deposited your 20,000, that was you done. You can take it, leave it, do what you like, but you can't have another allowance if you take that away again. Now you can put them back again with a flexible ISA. You have to replace them into the ISA that they came out of is the rule here. So you can't withdraw your 20,000 that you deposited and take it off to a different ISA provider and open a new ISA in the same year with the same cash by moving it like that. But what you can do is take it out, use it, put it back. I was having a look at the place that obviously we always go for the kind of information that we look for on this show, which is Martin Lewis and his website. And he was suggesting, or someone on his behalf, I think, was suggesting, he, broadly speaking, the institution that is Martin Lewis, was suggesting that what you might look to do is deposit into your ISA on April the 6th, withdraw it again, or take money out of your ISA on April the 6th, move it off somewhere else into a higher rate savings account and put it back again on April the 5th to keep you protected from the tax returns. I'm not entirely sure. I think that's a particularly interesting arbitrage opportunity, but I'm not sure how bad the rates on most ISAs are. I don't think there are any that I'd rather have it in terms of pure interest rate return than 212s at the moment at 5 point, whatever you said, nearly two, I think was your number for return on that. So I can't think I would want to withdraw it and put it anywhere else, to be honest. But strictly, if you find you need access to your cash, you can put it back again later if that becomes a possibility for you. So it's interesting stuff. I mean, I think it's a generally positive move. I think not kind of forcing people to keep their cash tied up in cash because of a decision they made or risk the kind of tax consequences of that is a good thing. I also like the fact in the case of trading 212 that cash means cash. I share your reasonable sense of security about QMMF, but look, I can understand that if it says cash ISA on the tin, it probably ought to be in cash. People have a right to keep their money in cash. Could be their emergency fund that they can then replace if they want to. Or even if for whatever reason they just want that money in cash, they should be able to put it in a thing that's cash and not a disguised financial product of some other sort. So I think flexible ISAs look interesting. If I had a bigger ISA allowance, maybe I'd consider putting some of mine in there as well. But as it is, I'm probably in 212 and the other part of that business, to be honest. How about you, Steve?
Yeah, same as you. I don't really have a use for it at the moment. I think I can see why other people would have a use for it. I think it's going to be a quite popular product if it gets into the hands of people like Martin Lewis, and he can, you know, he'll want to have a play with the platform first, because he'll want to see how separated it is from things like the CFDs and things like Invest and what have you. He'll want to see that they're separate products. And Trading 212 have confirmed that they are. There's essentially going to be another tab at the top, so you can have your CFD tab, your ISA tab, your Invest tab, and a Cash ISA tab for those that are eligible. So yeah, for me, I can see it as a really positive step. I think for people who want to hold cash and want to hold it flexibly, that the beauty of it is you can now put your emergency fund in that and benefit from the higher interest rates tax-free without having to worry. At 5.2% interest, you don't need an awful lot in there, Steve, depending on what your salary is, before you start hitting the personal savings allowance, which is $1,000 as a low rate taxpayer, basic rate taxpayer, $500 if you're higher rate, and you get zero as an additional rate. So using ISAs and SIPs for people in additional rate is really important. So yeah, really good move, really interesting move. I'm all for it, Stephen. I think, yeah, can't wait for this one to launch. And yeah, let us know in the comment section if you're planning on using it. I haven't seen an ISA that's even close to competing with this. They normally have this kind of weird ISA, you know, this is a bit of a pain in the ass for us to administer, sort of tax on the top of it, where, you know, the Nationwide, for example, is only 3.25. So it's nearly double, Steve. It's quite a bit bigger than that. So, yeah, it's a positive move. It's a great rate. And be interested here in the comment section if people are planning on using it.
Interesting stuff. Steve, should we get to talking about stocks? I can see that things have been happening in the investments that I have for my godsons. So maybe we should talk about some of those.
Okay, no, let's do Disney then quickly. So I have read the earnings. I've used a mixture of CNBC and FinChat to just put this piece together. So let's see how we go. Revenue came in at $22.08 billion. That was up 1% year on year versus $22.11 billion expected. So only a small miss. It is actually the fourth consecutive top line miss for Disney, though. Earnings per share came in at $1.21. That's adjusted versus $1.10 adjusted. That was expected. They're adjusting here for restructuring and impairment charges, which are obviously hopefully one-offs. But if you don't want to adjust for it, there was a loss attributable to the company of about $20 million, which was about 1 cent per share, compared to profit of about $1.27 billion or 69 cents per share in the same period. Last year. In terms of streaming, Disney streaming services, Disney and Hulu achieved profitability this year, this quarter, but actually lost $18 million when you factor in ESPN. Whilst this is much narrower than the $659 million they lost as a division last year, the company anticipates that its combined streaming businesses will be fully profitable by the end of Q4 2024. Disney Plus core paid subscribers. The number of core paid subscribers reached 117.6 million by the end of Q2 2024. That was 12% growth. This excludes Disney Plus Hotstar in India and other countries in the region. As executives said on Tuesday's call, that they don't expect to actually see any customer growth in the third quarter, though, but they do expect to return to subscriber growth in the fourth quarter. The recent deal with cable company Charter, we saw some cable packages receive subscriptions to Disney's ad tier. This actually went into effect in the past quarter, which helped drive some of this growth in that segment, although it has partially diluted the average revenue per user as it's a cheaper service. That said, average monthly revenue per subscriber actually increased to $7.28. It was up about 12.5% on the previous financial year. Disney's TV business continued to lag as millions of Americans drop off cable TV each year. ESPN's revenue actually rose 3% to $4.21 billion, but its operating income dropped 9% to $799 million. A drop in cable subscribers, mixed that with some higher programming costs attributable to the college football playoff, led to this decline. ESPN's advertising revenue increased, though, to offset the subscriber losses. So some good, some bad in that part. In terms of linear network revenue across Disney's portfolio, excluding ESPN, that fell 8% to $2.77 billion, Operating income actually slumped 22% to $752 million. Disney cited that this was basically fewer subscribers, a drop-off in international affiliate fees due to contract rate decreases, and advertising revenue decreases due to a lower average viewership were also a factor. In terms of content sales, licensing and other revenue, which includes box office sales, that fell 40% in the quarter to $1.39 billion. Disney didn't actually have any films, blockbuster films, released in the quarter. And also last year's quarter included the benefit of the ongoing performance of the latest Avatar film, which generated nearly $2.3 billion in global box office sales. So tough comps mixed with not really anything in the quarter. I don't think the 40%, although it's a shocking number, not something you should particularly worry about. In terms of the studio slate, the film studios are gearing up for several major releases expected to drive significant box office revenue in the coming months and into 2025. On sports viewership, they said ESPN recorded exceptionally high viewership, marking its best April primetime viewership ever. This was driven by popular events like the NCAA women's basketball and the NFL playoffs. In terms of its cost efficiency initiatives, you may remember if you watched this show before, we said that Disney was on track to make $7.5 billion in annualized cost efficiency. But it actually says it's going to do nearly over it's going to exceed the $7.5 billion in cost efficiency targets, and thinks that it'll projects that it'll make about $8 billion in free cash flow over the next financial year. The dividend, Steve, because that's a very important thing, is going to be 75 cents. That's a yield of about 0.85%. In terms of valuation metrics, now, knowing what you know above and knowing that we're still adjusting out for bits and pieces, you'll note that the price to earnings ratio is about 114.5. That's pretty premium based on when you look at that, you know, very slowing revenue growth, I guess. But when you factor in the fact that there's box office things coming in the future, cost efficiency coming, and then all these one-time things coming off the bottom of earnings, I would expect that number to come down to something more like the mid-20s, maybe early 20s, probably this time next year. In terms of outlook, Steve, they actually raised the full-year EPS growth target by about 25%, which indicated that they think there's going to be a fairly positive outlook for the rest of the year. They said that their strategic initiatives across its diverse entertainment and media portfolio are expected to continue driving growth and profitability. So I think this was a mixed report, Steve. I can see why Wall Street sent this one down about 10% on the day after it. But I think there's plenty in there to hang on to, Steve, and plenty on there that, you know, to make the Disney shareholders sort of just look to the future a little bit and understand that, yeah, right now, not so good. But there's plenty of good still ahead of us.
AJ Bell said in their kind of commentary on this that the market had sent the stock down because the guide was weak. I don't know whether they're right, but I can see why they're saying it. And I am critical of them when I don't think they're right about something. I mean, the kind of flagging cable revenues was sort of known about in that Charter reported back at the start of April and basically said, look, subscriber numbers were coming in lower. So you got a kind of idea that was coming anyway if you were paying attention to elsewhere in the kind of industry. I'm not massively surprised to hear it's now 100 times earnings. I mean, if you think you're effectively missing one of your gap earnings because you said it was negative a cent, basically. So you'll lose part of that and then a bit more along the way as you kind of integrate various things and restructure left and right. That's going to weigh on things. I wouldn't worry about the PE ratio on this. I'd keep an eye on that free cash flow number. I thought that was quite impressive, starting to come through, because Disney is insistent on paying a dividend to its shareholders. I'm struggling to find my way into the mind, which is not a good thing, because my next contribution here is a stock for Paul, of the investor who thinks that that kind of dividend is somehow meaningful to them with everything else that's kind of going on in the rest of the business. I guess for Disney, this is, I think, is a reasonably positive result, and I think probably important for the company as well, because they've just managed to fend off their activist kind of interference. So seeing things at least shaping in the right direction is encouraging. You can have a slow quarter in growth around kind of Hotstar related stuff. We can live with that, I think. But that was the bit that kind of that was a bit that kind of caught the attention of investors, I guess, possibly because I think nearly all the rest of this you could probably have seen with enough kind of knowledge of what was going on elsewhere, is my kind of reaction to this. So yeah, fine, in my view, I think.
Yeah, other bits and pieces in the call, Steve, were that Disney's recommitted to spending about $6 billion a year over the next 10 years on parks to expand them, rebuild areas of them, and just generally improve them, which is obviously going to be really important. And in terms of releases coming up in 2025, they said that there's going to be a new Captain America, which is a very sort of popular Marvel film. There's going to be a new Snow White. There's going to be a new Fantastic Four, a new Tron, a new Blade, a new Zootopia, and they think a new Avatar. So that would come out towards the back end of the year. So just off that list there, there's some pretty cracking shows coming up. And they announced, Steve, as well, that there's going to be a new Mickey Mouse Clubhouse coming to Disney Junior and Disney Plus as well. So we have that to look forward to as well, Steve.
Good news for me, then, in that case. Not good news for people like, I mean, to an extent, Nelson Peltz, I think, but Elon Musk is a good candidate for this, who has been kind of disappointed with new versions of what we might say familiar shows, or in some cases, really quite old shows in there. And the company kind of reusing some of that kind of story content that it has in its kind of library. What's your view there, Steve? I could sort of see, I understand what they're saying there, but I don't think I'd go along with it. You're happy enough with this?
Yeah, really, really happy with it. I think, to be fair, there's a lot of negative sentiment around Disney at the moment, so it's easy to get distracted. The instant angle from any kind of news story on Disney is always straight onto the negative. And when I see something like that, I often tend to think, well, I'm going to have to look into this a little bit deeper, because if somebody's just going to scream woke just because they didn't like that, you know, the new Little Mermaid was a different skin color to the old one, I just need to understand a little bit more about that. And there's a lot of people that will come up to you and say that, like, that they're bored of Disney films, therefore they've sort of extrapolated that everybody's bored of Disney films, and that just doesn't play out. If you look at the box office stats for Disney films, they've got like eight of the best, the top 10 adjusted for inflation films of the last few decades. Eight of them are Disney products. And even when you look at films that people come out and say are flops, they're still doing like £400-500 million in box office revenue internationally. And I don't see how you can call something that's doing that amount of revenue, a flop. One of the other things that was hidden in the back of the call was that they have 1,000 acres of land in a land bank ready to go at Disney. And I was working that out, Steve, and that's enough to build 7 new Disneyland parks. Now, some of these is land that's attached to parks already, so there will be expansion. But if you think Disney can't do anything from here, we're talking about flat revenue growth here in a period when they've got no films out. And then you look at that film content slate that's coming up, you've got this period of efficiency. When that period of efficiency ends, you're going to have these films ready to go, attracting box office revenue. You've got this massive investment into the parks and media. And then you've got this like ESPN just rolling in the background, you know, ready to turn on the taps, Disney Plus starting to contribute, profitability, Hulu starting to be profitable for Disney. There's a lot of stuff going on at this company, and there's a lot here to be, you know, there's a lot of good that isn't getting talked about a lot, Stephen. And I'm ready to focus on the good of Disney and let people worry about the political stuff and let them, you know, I think this is, I don't want to say it's the blood on the streets moment, because we're looking at a rich valuation here, but I think under that valuation, when you dig a little bit deeper, there's a lot coming. And if it pays off, Steve, this stock looks cheap really quickly.
How many acres did you say they had again there, Steve? Sorry, I got distracted just momentarily as I was looking something up, and I'll tell you what in a second, but remind me how many acres you said there, sorry?
1,000 acres.
Cool, thank you. So, when I think about the kind of reusing similar themes and content and so on, I get that you can view that as kind of lazy a little bit and perhaps just trying to rest on the assets that they have a bit. But I also think, I mean, tell me any other company that wouldn't like to have those assets and just keep using them for the kind of money they can make with those things. It really does speak to the quality of those Disney intangibles. And I don't think anyone, even its critics, seriously kind of doubt the quality of that library. They just sort of feel like there's something a bit more, they want to see a bit more going on in terms of writing. But 1,000 Acres, by the way, I was just having a look at TruckNet UK, and according to TruckNet UK, in 1,000 Acres, what you could do is turn it into that many Disney parks, or you could park 150,000 unsold Teslas in there. That's roughly how many cars fit into an acre. I don't know why I brought that up. That's not even relevant. Should we talk about something else, Steve?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's talk about a stock that I was planning on pitching to Paul. I feel like I dreamed this at some point, but I have this idea in my head. It's been a really bumpy week, so I may well just be completely hallucinating this, that Paul like showed up in my DMs at one point and said he was gonna like come back on the show for a bit, and there he's not, because he's got another job somewhere else that he's now off on. And I think back on it, I may have hallucinated the entire damn thing, but I definitely have this idea that that happened. And it got me thinking about stocks that Paul might like to buy. Stocks for Paul, as we used to call it, if he's listening, if we kind of see him again. Here's one that I thought kind of fits Paul's profile. So Paul is what he describes as a dividend growth investor, which means he likes dividends that are going to go up over time as companies kind of get bigger or buy back shares or whatever. But for some reason, it's not enough for him to get a massive kind of yield that will carry on indefinitely in a sort of legal and general 9% like thing. He wants things that are going to grow. Okay, that's the style that works for him. Here's a company then that I was looking at the other day, and I think you've owned it before, Steve, or maybe briefly. I mean, between us, we've owned most things in the UK, to be honest, at some point briefly. I was thinking about buying it. And then the price went up, and now I'm not thinking about buying it anymore. But Paul might, because it is a growing dividend thing. Company is called Greggs, and they are a FTSE 250 company that run a chain of bakeries. Let's get to the dividend then, to be cut straight to the chase. It's around a 2.25% yield at the moment. You do get special dividends sort of reasonably often, making them kind of, I don't want to say predictable, but sort of less special when one appears. They show up every sort of every other year or something like three every 5 years or something along those lines. But yeah, so you get a little bit of a push from some extra special dividends. And the dividend's been growing pretty nicely, actually, over the last 10 years. It's not a big starting yield, but it is pushing itself up at around 10, 11% over a decade. If you keep that going, you will get to the point where you're getting a return of about 6.29%. If you can just keep going and holding on to that, you don't even have to reinvest if it grows at that rate. The real question is it going to grow at that rate, and how long is it going to grow at that rate for? The big driving growth engine for Greggs, and it has been driving and a growth engine, is basically expanding its store count. They think that the UK can take around 3,000 Greggs stores. They have, I think, tried international expansion before in Belgium, but in these places where they tend to go in for kind of fancier baked goods, be amazed to hear that the Greggs thing didn't really work out as well as it might have done. And that's they've kind of learned from that idea. And I think if you're thinking about this stock, or when you consider the prospects for this stock, I'm not sure this is a brand that travels terribly well outside the UK, but I think it's very, very strong in the UK. So they're looking at opening another 160 stores this year. They're at around 2,500 and looking to make their way to 3,000, sort of PDQ from what I can see of it. So if that happens, you should expect the growth to kind of continue, but you should also expect the growth to kind of slow, I think. Adding another 150, 160 stores every year is a lot when your store count is at 1,200. It's a bit when your store count's at 2,500, and it's less when your store count's at sort of 2,800 or so. So the growth rate will slow if the rate of expansion remains steady. This is one of the things that Chris Bloomstring kind of says about Costco. He's a big fan of it, but they expand at a steady rate, opening sort of 20 or 30 new stores every year. And that's not as big an addition to the store count now in percentage terms as it was kind of back when they had a couple of hundred stores in various places. They have other kind of growth opportunities available. They're trying to work out, as you would if you thought you were getting near to your kind of capacity, how to get more from the stores that they have. And that involves sticking tables in them and trying to turn them into cafes, mostly, where people will try and spend more money and buy more things. Whether that will work with Greggs, I'm not entirely sure, but it's well worth a look. The interesting thing with their expansion, though, at the moment is they are, you wouldn't be entirely unsurprised to hear, supply constrained, which means that they are currently selling all the steak bakes and sausage rolls they can make with their current manufacturing. So further store expansions will need further investments in manufacturing, which means that it's not just as straightforward as the setup costs are higher than just the cost of opening a new store. You need manufacturing to support those things. Probably well worth it to Greggs, but if you're kind of mapping out that growth, there's cost to come with that as well, at least in the kind of short term. When I saw this before, it was about 18 times earnings. It's now at about 20 times earnings, and it's weird that between those two numbers, I actually like it quite a bit less than when I first saw it. I sort of thought at 18, yeah, this looks kind of not too bad. I mean, it's worth pointing out, I suppose, that there are some obvious features here. It's a pretty resilient business. It actually reacted very well during the pandemic in terms of looking for online channels and shifting consumer collection and that kind of thing. They have an app that provides them with plenty of data about their consumers, which is going down very well. I was asked to look into YouGov by one of our listeners, which I've sort of started doing, but I immediately got distracted by the fact that they are top of YouGov's British dining brands or UK dining brands. I'm not sure. I guess you do have to call them a dining brand. I sort of call them a food company, but realistically, that's probably the same thing. One thing they have about them is they have this profit sharing thing with employees where they essentially share a percentage of the profits with employees. I've been there for more than 6 months on a variable kind of basis. Games Workshop have this as well. I am in a kind of minority of about one, I think, of not being a massive fan of this scheme. I heard Boss Hog talking about it in the context of Games Workshop. And he made the point legitimately that it's not nice to see companies gouging their employees. And I think he's right about that. I'd rather you paid them properly, to be honest, rather than doing it through profit sharing things. I think there's a difference between being an employee and being a shareholder. The stuff that's left over after we paid employees is for shareholders, but you should pay the employees properly in the first place, is my sort of thought with that. So I'm not sure about that as a model. But there was a thing of that I was reading about from Investor Chronicle, which is called the comfort of only. And this is to do with an inflationary world, right? So when prices go up, the idea that your steak bake has gone up by only 20p or something like that doesn't feel like a big hit. You're kind of all right with that. Bearing in mind you only pay about £2 for a steak bake anyway, it's actually a 10% hike, which is quite a lot compared to sort of inflation at 3. But when you have a low price product, you can get away with those kind of little increases more, and people don't sort of massively mind in the same way. Whereas if you increase the price of any of these kind of luxury brands, things we've been talking about, by £50, suddenly it looks that bit more expensive, even if that's a much lower percentage increase. I think that's an interesting point in the way people think about things. And I say that as someone who owns shares in Spoons. But there's something good at resilient about that. It feels to me very Peter Lynch of go look at the place that always has a queue outside it in a recession. That's always a Greggs. I work in the middle of Oxford. There's always a queue outside the damn Greggs. I wasn't even aware it was there for a long time, but it is, and it's pretty much always busy. Price-wise, I'm probably just slightly hesitant at the moment, but you know, I'd probably try and convince Paul to buy this because fits his prime profile of stuff, I think, Steve. You owned it a while back, right?
Yeah, I think I owned this one, and I want to say back in 2018 or 2019. It was a stock that I really liked. And I actually like the food as well, Steve. Being a northerner, the food is pretty good. But I'm cheap as hell, Steve. I like to bake it myself. The Iceland frozen range of Greggs is absolutely spectacular. And cooking it in your own oven comes through like so well. You can get 8 steak bakes for a tenner from Iceland, from the Greggs range. And they come out absolutely perfect, as do the dog rolls, as well, the sausage rolls. So, yeah, really, really... really, really good. But yeah, in terms of the company, Steve, Yeah, I think I'm the same as you. I think it's a little bit expensive. I think at 18 times earnings, it's obviously a lot more palatable than 20 times earnings. And yeah, I'm just reading their Investing for Success page now in their investor presentation. And 2024 is going to be a big year for them. They're basically spending a lot of money on capacity and productivity, bringing in a hell of a lot of double-deck trucks so that they can send more out, and additional warehousing and additional manufacturing facilities. And they're starting to develop two brand new state-of-the-art facilities as well in the Midlands as well. So Greggs are really doubling down on this, and they're going to need it. If they're going to get to this store target, 3,000 store target, I think you said it was, Steve. If they're going to get to that, they're going to need all the help they can get to get there. And yeah, let's hope that the quality stays with it. One of the places that I'm sort of perpetually surprised that they haven't gone to yet, because I've never met an American who's tried a Greggs and not absolutely loved it, is America. Pastry and barely beef inside of pastry, and you know, sausage rolls that are probably 15% pork. I don't know, that might be slanderous. They might be better than that, but all of
the vegan ones are 15% pork, aren't they?
The vegan ones are great, but they taste like stuffing. But yeah, in America, I can just imagine Greg's doing so well. More on the pastry side of it, less on the sort of coffee side of it. I don't think Greg's has the kind of sweet treat range, but I'm surprised they haven't tried to kind of like franchise out the, you know, the pastry arm of it, or maybe put their pastry arm into, you know, like a Dutch Brothers or whatever, some that kind of chain, and see how that would do. They could ship the Iceland frozen pastries over there and get Dutch Brothers to warm them up. But yeah, I'm so perpetually surprised that hasn't been explored, and maybe it has been explored, Steve, and we're not giving them the credit. But at 20 times earnings, to get to 3,000 stores, Steve, this looks like a cheap stock. At 18 times earnings, it's even cheaper. It's all about how you feel they get to that stores and the sort of process that they take to get there. Now, it's a very well-run operation. I don't see them, you know, racking up massive amounts of debt. I think, a pandemic aside, they're a pretty profitable outfit. Their app is pretty good. It's feeding a lot of information and data back to them that they're using to sort of tailor their offers. And yeah, the click and collect there is pretty decent as well. And like you say, Steve, we've got a few near us. There's always queues out the door of them. So I don't know, Steve. It's quite an impressive outfit. I mean, we're looking at same store sales growth of what, about 13.5%. If you compare like for like, 13.7%. Sales growth top line of 19.6%. I don't think you're a million miles away from something being fairly priced here. I don't know, Steve. If I was Paul, I would be a little bit more tempted than maybe you sold it.
Yeah, I might be as well. I got kind of comparing this with Starbucks that we looked at kind of the other week. Balance sheet wise, there isn't a kind of comparison. They have a very good balance sheet. They tend to remain kind of cash positive. Starbucks doesn't do that, and deliberately doesn't do that. It runs at negative working capital because that helps growth and it helps go faster, basically. If you insist on keeping cash on your balance sheet, as Greg's does, it's a better kind of insurance policy, but you could be using that to build out your store count. Different ways of thinking about these things, but I feel like Starbucks is, Greggs is, I think it's still, 18 I definitely thought it, at 20 I guess I'm not entirely sure. Kind of gets whacked by the UK tax a little bit here. I think if this was, if you took the name off it, stuck a US name on it, and listed it on the New York Stock Exchange, I think this trades at a higher multiple, which, given its kind of other numbers here. I've seen some of their kind of stuff in Iceland. It's a weird one. It's never occurred to me to go into a supermarket and buy a Greggs to have at home. I should probably do that. I feel like it's a thing I ought to do, but I associate Greggs as being so damn cheap when I'm out anyway, that I don't kind of worry too much at home. It's strictly a cyclical that feels like a defensive, I think. I don't think it's going to kind of chop around much in the macro economy. But maybe we'll find out what Paul thinks one day, yeah?
Yeah, so on to Progeny, Steve, which is probably needed because of Greggs's effects on the populace. So Progeny was down about 30% on the open, Stephen, and overnight it did re-claw about 13 percentage points of that back, so down about 17% on the day. It was quite a bleak report, but I will just quickly fly through it and let's see what you think. But revenue for Q1 2024, they posted revenue of $278.1 million. It was about an 8% increase year over year. About $169.8 million of that was from fertility benefit services, about $108.3 million of it from pharmacy benefit services. It was actually a slight dip if you compare quarter to quarter, and they attributed this to lower utilization rates in states that have restrictive reproductive healthcare laws and new restrictive reproductive healthcare laws, but also that there was a general reluctance to start a family whilst layoffs in tech, which is Progeny's biggest sector, are so prevalent, which is sensible. Just to stick my nose in there. In terms of adjusted EBITDA for the quarter, it's about $50.3 million. EPS was about 18 cents, which is actually a decrease of 7% over the previous quarter. This decline is part of a broader trend where the EPS growth rate has been fluctuating a little bit over the recent years. Operational highlights. So Progeny continues to expand its service offerings. It was venturing into new areas such as menopause, maternity, and postpartum care, which are expected to drive future growth. The company has seen a strong start to the current selling season, robust pipeline, and some early commitments from new clients, indicating that there is still positive momentum in its business operations. In terms of its outlook, it said it remained optimistic about the long-term trends in the fertility services market, driven by continuing to rise infertility rates and a sustained demand for these services. They expected that revenue will grow about 15% at the midpoint and anticipated that there'll be a continued expansion in its margins. In terms of its financial metrics, so it has a market cap of about $3 billion, an enterprise value of about $2.77 billion. It bought back a small amount of stock in the quarter, probably not really worth mentioning, but here we go. The company's profitability metrics include a gross margin of about 22%, an EBITDA margin of about 6%, and a net profit margin of about 5.5%. So it's demonstrated significant revenue growth. Its three-year revenue growth is about 42.13%, five-year 53.43%, which gives you a price-to-earnings ratio of about 41.8, nearly 42, and enterprise value to sales of about 2.5. So still trading a little bit rich, but nothing too out there for the sort of future growth that's ahead of it. In terms of operational highlights, the company emphasized that its operational excellence and its expansion of its adjusted EBITDA margins are what they would hope investors would focus on, rather than the sort of short-term pain that they're experiencing at the moment. They said that there was a slight dip in utilization due to essentially the decision by the Alabama Supreme Court. They said that utilization has actually since rebounded and is currently above the levels that they saw in 2022. The selling season for 2025 has started very strongly. They said Progeny's pipeline and early commitments surpassed the previous years. The company is on track to meet or exceed its target of adding 1.3 million lives covered. Additionally, it's expanding its services, as previously said, but these services are expected to have slightly lower margins compared to its more sort of core fertility service. So I think it's got a pretty strong competitive position in the market, significant opportunities for growth. And again, they said that there'll be more details on their growth drivers will be discussed at their upcoming analyst day. I can see why this stock has gone down today. That's a pretty big drop in revenue, and maybe somewhat short-sighted by the market, seeing that these rulings wouldn't hurt not just the market, me as well, but seeing that these rulings in Alabama and the other sort of Midwestern states would hurt the utilization rates at Progeny. But I just can't see anything other than this being a short-term problem, Steve. I think this is something that the company can overcome relatively quickly. I think there's a probably slight threat of the sort of two Republican candidates potentially making life a little bit difficult for Progeny again, but they're not, again, presidents are not something that you should pick stocks around, I don't think. I think they're again, in terms of their terms, short-term problems for the stock. And I just can't see anything other than that this was a buying opportunity for me, Steve. And I did buy the position, got about 25% bigger than it was, the day before, in terms of share count. But yeah, I couldn't see anything other than this being a buying opportunity. Steve, is there anything really in here that you think is a real long-term problem that we should be worried about?
No, I don't think there's anything in there that's a real long-term problem. I actually think there's a long-term... I think I picked up more than one thing here that I thought was a short-term issue. The kind of rulings are maybe one thing. I think with these things, they might feel scarier than they are, and it's not entirely unreasonable for them to feel scarier than they are, in that this is a company operating in a relatively new space. It has a first mover advantage, and it's going to scale quite fast and probably better tech than anyone else. So big advantage in that space. But regulation around that space is kind of a little bit uncertain at the moment. Whenever you're doing something new, there's always questions of how legislators are going to react. And I think it's difficult to, or at least it's not obvious to me, what precedent might look like in this kind of space. So I understand, even if I think it might ultimately prove to be wrong, I'm not critical of anyone kind of having a quite shaky, uncertain reaction to that in the way that I normally am. I mean, you said they hope investors might focus on their adjusted EBITDA margin. I mean, surely that's the reason anyone provides an adjusted EBITDA margin, because you're hoping investors are going to focus on it. No one's kind of gap requiring that. I mean, the metrics you talked about of sort of 40, nearly 2x earnings and 2.5x EV to sales, these close up quite a bit, don't they, as margins expand effectively, if you kind of think that net margin's going to come higher than the sort of slightly below 6% where it currently is. A bit of a movement in that suddenly brings that PE ratio down quite a bit, even without needing massive amounts of sales growth. By the way, I think there is actually pretty decent sales growth potential here. You mentioned that people delaying starting families, you thought it was kind of, in your view, sensible. I agree with you that I think it's sensible, but I also find it surprising. I kind of sort of think that there's a feeling around the people that kind of I know that are thinking about these sorts of things, in that you might delay it or decide to delay it, and I can see why that might be reasonable, but they're sort of a bit more worried that it's not clear that sort of next year or 2 years looks much better, to be honest, with the kind of concerns they have. I mean, we had hours while we were getting ready to move house, basically. He was about sort of 2.5 months old, and we went to go and live with our friend, and then he was about 6 months old. We went to go and live with my in-laws, and then he was about 9 months old, and we finally moved in here. So we kind of jumped into it fairly two-footed. We were okay financially, in fairness, but we were in quite a sort of choppy time. I think quite a few people kind of think, or there is a kind of class of people who think that, well, look, the practical realities are tricky, but people have rights to start families. And so they're kind of going to do it whether or not they're really in a position to do that, or whether they think they're in a financial position to do that as well. So there's two thoughts there. One of a class of people who think, I want a family and I ought to be able to have one. And also a line of thought that says, yeah, but I could delay, but I don't know that tomorrow is necessarily going to be any better. So I think the people that are delaying will stop delaying sooner or later, and maybe sooner rather than later. Which speaks well for kind of revenue growth effectively for Progyny. So I'm kind of thinking that there's, I'm not saying in the next quarter or so, but give it another 8 to 12 quarters, and I wouldn't be surprised to see this company's revenues are much, much higher than they are as this kind of wears off, even if interest rates don't fall by that much.
Yeah, for me, I still see this as being my... probably one of my best ideas for big winners. I think I've caught this at a really, really interesting time in its development. I think we've sort of, it's de-risked in the sense that it's profitable, and we've now seen it's profitable even when it's taking a bit of a, you know, a bit of outside stress. It still retains its a decent profitability, and I think the services that it delivers, Steve, they're always going to be in demand, and demand for them is likely to increase, and the companies that that buy services from Progyny are using them as employee retention And after big layoffs, one of the things you want to do is try and retain the good staff that you've left behind. So I think Progeny's services only increase. The tech staff that are leaving these big companies are going to expect this, you know, level of service when they go to, you know, other tech companies. I see this as sort of just a constant flywheel of growth for Progeny. And I don't really have any issue with it whatsoever. If the market wants to give me a 30% off coupon this morning and I've got a little bit of cash, I will take that voucher and I will buy some shares. And that's exactly what I did.
It feels to me like this week, actually, that feels like a nice kind of timely welcome opportunity. This week doesn't feel to me like a week of obvious buying opportunities. It sort of feels to me a week where mostly things have gone higher, to be honest. And my screen looks very nice if you're the kind of person that likes seeing green numbers on their things, because it's nice to think your investments are up and you could sell them for more than you bought them for, even if you don't want to sell them. But even with the things I've thought about selling, I thought, I don't really know where I want to go with the kind of cash when I've got there. So if anyone happens to be listening from any of the companies that I own shares in, I mean, I wouldn't mind a flash 30% drop on something. Berkshire Hathaway would do. I'm not going to speculate about how we might get to such a thing. But yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing a bit of a dip in this kind of market. So it feels like a nice time to be seeing something at a big discount to where it was.
What have you got for us next, Steve?
I've been looking at a company called Porvair recently. This is a pretty small UK business. It has a market cap of about 295 million, and it's an industrial company that manufactures, or designs and manufactures, filtration equipment. This gets used in labs for things like sample filtering, aerospace, for things like air filtering, and metal melt quality. So this is an example of where I've been kind of looking at a few different UK stocks recently and companies and working out how they're supposed to work and what makes for kind of good performance and interesting business models that didn't necessarily stand out to me from my own experience in the world the way that something like Greggs does. But I've been, as you might well know, looking at the likes of Halma and Diploma and thinking about why they've been successful and what it is that they look for in targets to acquire and so on. I don't see this as an acquisition target for either of these companies, by the way. It does a little bit of acquiring by itself, but I think there's a lot in common here between this and some of the kind of high-performing UK conglomerates that I really like, but depending on what day it is, struggle with the price tag on them. So we'll come back to those in a moment. So they focus on filtration equipment, and they are aiming to make things that are inexpensive to their customers, but also critical. So things that they can't do without, and we talked about in the case of Diploma, how that sort of means that actually through the cycle, you tend to get relatively stable demand because people aren't going to ground an aircraft for the want of a filter, at least not willingly anyway. In the same way with Diploma, people are not going to switch off a machine just because it needs a new seal on part of it. It's an interesting kind of model they have that focuses on ways in which they might try and find kind of competitive strong positions to occupy. So their filters and labs are typically single use, so they're thrown away, they need replacing. We'll come back to those in a little bit, but that helps generate repeat business for them. Aerospace wise, their filters are typically kind of specified in airframes, so there's not much choice for switching away for manufacturers there. And they have a pretty good reputation for quality as well. And when you're looking at kind of low-cost stuff that's important, you don't really want to be taking risks by looking for different and cheaper suppliers. So they have pretty good relations with their customers, and that keeps them coming back for more stuff, whether or not they kind of have a choice. We talked about Croda International, another decent UK company, a fair bit. And one thing we've talked about recently is that inventory levels in the medical and lab and healthcare industry tend to be pretty high at the moment. They're still working their way down from kind of COVID levels. So that's been kind of slowing up that part of the business just lately. However, one thing that's very much gone the other way is aerospace, and planes and flights and demands and air travel and all that kind of stuff has actually responded pretty well. So what you've seen over the last sort of 5 years or so is different parts of this going through a specific kind of cyclical shift. So filters for aircraft fell away during the pandemic when nothing was getting used for flying. And there was a big surge in demand on kind of lab testing filters. That's pretty much reversed for the time being, which has actually got them a little bit more stability than you might think, albeit there's been a kind of really interesting specific sort of pressure on their different components. So this sounds a little bit Halmer, it sounds a little bit Diploma, strong position, highly niche area, work close to customers, be difficult to disrupt from above because it's not really worth the cash to try and compete for someone bigger, be difficult to disrupt from below because your position is strong enough to push away competition. And if that kind of sounds familiar, then trust your sort of instincts. I went looking a bit further back down the chain. It's not a massively acquisitive conglomerate, so it's not growing at quite the same rate, but you've managed sort of 73% in terms of revenue growth over the last 10 years. So yeah, around 7% touch under that maybe. And earnings per share up 150% over the same time. That's through COVID, of course, which has been a choppy time for different parts of the business. Yeah, I mentioned Halmer Diploma, a few other things, but those things are kind of tricky because it's hard to pay 37 or 43 times earnings and imagine that your thing is trading at a UK discount. In the case of both of those companies, you'd have absolutely fine if you bought them at high multiples sort of 10 years ago. So I'm aware that there is a kind of obvious counterpoint to what I'm sort of talking about feelings-wise there. But Porvair's now trading at around 18 times earnings. It was 16 when I started writing this a couple of weeks ago. But that is a much, much lower number. It doesn't have the same cash conversion as Halmer and Diploma. It's not as asset light as those businesses are. But I think it's well worth a look. And I'm not saying that as a stock for Paul. I'm saying that as a stock for civilized people. Steve, you look like you're looking at something important on your screen there.
Just reading the chairman's report, Steve, it's not a company I know a lot about. Quite interesting to see, though, that they've essentially had a tricky year, is what they would describe it as. It's been really inconsistent. There's been the year previous, there was quite a lot of quite a lot of heavy buying. This year has been a destocking year, so they've had trouble. Basically, you know, inconsistent demand for their product. Yet they've still grown at 2% on the top line. Operating profit has grown by 7%. If you want to adjust it by, I'm not entirely sure what they're adjusting out here, but it's 10% higher. It's actually done really well, and the track record of growth over the last sort of 5 and 10 years is also really good. The revenue growth over the last, well, over the last 15 years is an 8% CAGR. The earnings per share growth is 11% CAGR. Cash from operations, 207.6 million over that period as well. So really quite impressive little outfit here, really, in terms of metrics for 17 times earnings. And they're on a lot of sort of trends, global trends that could offer opportunities for them. So things like tightening environmental regulation, the need for clean water, carbon efficient transportation, moving away from plastic to and steel to things like aluminium, and manufacturing processes, analytical science. These are all areas in which they have quite strong sort of market penetration and products that they can offer and solutions that they can offer for these industries. So quite an impressive little outfit, not trading at a particularly high valuation at all, a market cap of £286 million. So you get quite a lot of company for your money here, quite tidy on the dividend as well. They make a lot more money than they dish out in dividend, and so there's plenty of room for them to, you know, to increase that should they wish to. Or to maybe offer a special or even go out and acquire and grow from that point onwards. So, yeah, it all looks pretty good to me, Steve, here. I can't really spot anything that's jumping out at me here that I am, you know, particularly worried about at all. So, yeah, interesting one, Steve. One to definitely take more of a look at.
With companies this size, we sometimes sort of think of them as potential acquisition targets, especially when they're UK ones. And it feels like the FTSE 250 is getting taken away one by one until it will become the FTSE 25 or something like that. But this doesn't feel to me like it's trading. Usually what you need to be an interesting acquisition target is some sort of valuable asset, pretty low price tag and some idea that you could be meaningfully integrated into someone else's kind of business to, I don't know, cut costs or expand distribution or something. And I can see two of those in Porvair's case. I can see an asset that's worth having, and I can see meaningful scope for improvement in terms of distribution and so on. Although they are actually a bit more spread out than you might think for a company of this size. They try and operate kind of closer to their customers and do their manufacturing near where the stuff is going. What I'm not seeing, though, is an obvious kind of bargain basement price on this. When we think about the kind of serial acquirers, and indeed the people that are kind of thinking of acquiring at the moment, we sort of normally think more kind of single digit somethings. It's not clear to me this is in that sort of territory. So I don't mind that. I'm not particularly interested in buying companies just because I think they're going to get acquired. But even at a sort of 295 million and being pocket change for kind of pretty much any FTSE 100 company that isn't in specific trouble at the moment, I'm not sure I think there's the kind of acquisition probable upside here. Now that I've said that, it will probably be taken private next week. But yeah, that's the bit I'm not quite seeing from what we would normally look at here. But yeah, I think this is interesting. Steve, should we get back to kind of more familiar territory though?
Just before we do, they've got four, they've got five strategic priorities in this report, Stephen. Four of them sound great. So they're basically saying they want to allocate capital to higher growth segments, increase efficiency, and increase capacity. So that's admirable. Place an emphasis on skills development, talent and training in a devolved management structure. Sounds great. Acquire suitable bolt-on assets as appropriate. Sounds good. Support new product development. That sounds great. And then meet our ESG targets. And you're just like, oh, you could have stopped without that one. It is one of these 144-page reports with about 40 pages dedicated to ESG, unfortunately, when I think that is a bit of a box-ticking exercise. But look, this is a company with a really conservative balance sheet. And, you know, I think they're doing all right, Steve. Do you want me to shuffle on or do you have something?
No, I don't have anything on the subject of ESG, at least not today anyway. I mean, I have loads on it, but not in the context of this company.
Okay. So the last one we'll do is Airbnb, and we're going to just rattle through this one. So I haven't actually listened to the call, I'm not going to lie to you, and I forgot to ask FinChat to summarize it. So here we go. Revenue came in at $2.1 billion, that was up 18%. Gross profit was $1.7 billion, that's up 20%, so that's a 78% margin. Net income came in at $264 million, that's up 126%. And that's a 12% margin. Free cash flow was $1.9 billion, up 21%, and 89% margin. And reminder that this is Q1, so this is when people tend to book their holidays, leave their money with Airbnb, but don't actually go on the holiday until later in the year. So this free cash flow is artificially higher than how it should be. Trailing 12-month revenue was $10.2 billion, that was up 18%. Operating cash flow, trailing 12 months of $4.2 billion, up 11%, a 41% margin. And just to explain that point again, trailing 12-month free cash flow, $4.2 billion, up 22%, a margin of about 41%. So the margin is more like 40, but still high, but more like 40 than 89%. In terms of nights and experiences, book, Steve, that was up 9% to 133 million. A gross booking value of about 22.9 billion, which was up 12%. The daily rate was $173, which was up about 3%. Airbnb's take rate was 9.3%, just up slightly. Active listings was up 15%. And long-term stays, which is what Airbnb calls anybody staying over 28 nights, which is a long time, really. That was 17%, sorry, of total bookings. In terms of the guide, they said that revenue will increase about $2.74 billion in the next quarter. That will only be a jump of 10%. Now, the reason for this that they gave was that Q3 is actually when the Olympics and what they called the Euro Cup is on, and they expected that some of that money is going to be going into that quarter rather than Q2. But they said that they expect the growth rates of nights to be fairly stable. The daily rate to be modestly up due to the mix shift, and they said adjusted EBITDA will be flat, margin will be slightly lower due to Easter timing and payment processing, and a slightly higher marketing expense. Full year 24 EBITDA, they said will still grow, and margin will be around 35%. Off the back of this, Steve, some analysts thought it was great, some analysts thought it was rubbish. Piper Sandler increased their price to 155, Gordon Haskett went to 116, JP Morgan went to 145, Citigroup went to 170, Goldman Sachs went to 130, BMO Capital went to 151. All of them went up quite significantly. But Deutsche Bank, they took theirs down $10 to 148. HSBC took theirs down $4 to 156. And TD Cowen took theirs down from 180 to 170. So, you know, five good, three not so bad. They were only small little downgrades. I thought this was a mighty fine report again, Steve. I think Airbnb is a real fine company. I would think around here it's probably still trading a little bit too expensive, but there's a lot of negativity around Airbnb, Steve, and it just keeps growing and growing and growing.
Yeah, it's a very impressive company, isn't it? It has an obviously very nice business model too. I don't know. I'm looking at Google at the moment and saying it's around 19.5 times earnings, which is not mad high for something that's free cash flow growth around in the 20-ish percent mark, and revenue growth of, I think you said, about 18 percent along the way there. Yeah, that 9% take rate actually stands out quite a bit. That's it's a touch higher than I thought it might be, and I do think that as they kind of set up their, as they set up their platform, they're pretty well set up. But as Vrbo no longer becomes a word that we use, and I haven't seen a Vrbo ad in quite a while, now, having reported the fact that I wasn't terribly impressed by them before. I wonder whether there might even be scope for that to kind of move higher as we go along. I was sort of surprised that they had much going on over 28 nights. At 28 nights, it feels like a kind of different type of booking to me. It doesn't feel like, well, I mean, it's like you're going for the entire Euro Cup, basically, for that sort of thing. And I suppose that could be still, you know, a holiday, but I sort of kind of, that feels to me more like moving house for a month than a kind of holiday somewhere. But that's sort of interesting to me as well. Cowen, you said, went down, but they're still kind of comfortably above where the share price is at the moment. It's at around 146 right now. So some of those analysts are actually getting quite close. When you said City at 170, I thought that sounds quite high. It's you know, plenty higher than 146, but it's not double or anything like that.
No, I don't think anybody's expecting a massive jump like that. But one of the interesting things that was sort of just hidden in the bottom of the report is that they essentially have about 20% of their market cap in cash at the moment, Steve. So when you work that out as an enterprise value, you get a significantly lower number. But it's key to remember that about 11.1 billion of that is cash on hand for them, and about 8.7 billion of that is held on behalf of guests. So there's a total of that 20 billion in cash. But Steve, they can put that into, you know, an interest-bearing account and generate a decent amount of cash just from holding people's deposits for them. It's an impressive business, Steve. They almost don't need a take rate. They just hold the money and take the interest rates. But obviously you can't, you know, if interest rates come down, then that might be a short-term thing. But impressive that they've been able to sort of manufacture a platform where they can actually do this.
Yeah, it's interesting, that thought, actually. I mean, they absolutely could stick it into some sort of short-term security, and arguably should be sticking it into a short-term security and collecting interest on it. It feels a little bit no-win for companies in this area some of the time, right? So you saw Wise, and to an extent, Hargreaves Lansdown, we're kind of a bit more positive on one of those companies generally than we are on the other one. But you've seen a similar thing from both, which is that both have reported very high income coming from cash they're holding from customers one way or another. And in general, the market has viewed this quite negatively. What they viewed it as is, that's not sustainable. That's not happening when rates go lower. And in fairness to those guys, both of them, the one we like and the one we're kind of less keen on, there is a question of the hell they're supposed to do with it. I mean, I go now, well, we're not going to be able to do that for very long, so we probably shouldn't take the 5.2% we can get by banging this into trading 212 now, because people will say this isn't sustainable, or this isn't going to last, or you can't run a business just based on this. I kind of like your thought, actually, with the way I think about the companies I own sort of investment-wise, that actually they could boost their competitive position by bringing down their take rate here and making it harder for kind of other entrants. And that could absolutely be a thing that they would do in this situation, just because their sheer size means that they're going to make plenty of money by even if they took a percent off the take here.
And the thing is that valuation wise, you're looking at this and saying, so where do we see some upside then, I guess? Is that, so if you take an EPS just based on the end of the year in December 31st, you got EPS of about $7.52. If they can grow that, Steve, to the sort of $9 range in the next sort of 3 years, Steve, and you want to put a 25 times multiple on that, you're looking at $225 in terms of valuation there. So that's, what's that, a decent upside on that, Steve, or 44% upside on where we are here? Is it 45% upside on where we are here? That's a decent return over a three-year period. That's a 15% return. And there's a little bit of movement in that number, before you're getting down to sort of an 8 or 10% return in that EPS number, and it's still being attractive. Now, maybe you might not think, you think a 25% 25 times multiple is a little bit high. Well, you drop that down to whatever you're comfortable with, Steve. But I would imagine you're going to find a little bit of upside still in this company if it can continue to grow. And at the moment, I just don't see a reason why it will continue to grow. It was down 8%. Why it won't continue to grow, sorry. But 8% down on these figures, Steve, and I thought they were pretty fine. I think this is another thing where the market is looking at this as a short-term issue and really not considering the long-term potential.
Yeah, I mean, the market has had strong feelings about Airbnb sort of historically in both directions, right? I mean, I just looked at its kind of, what is basically its all-time chart. I tried to find a five-year one, but didn't go back that far. And it's actually roughly where it sort of started. It got it came out very high. I mean, it's not so long ago that we were talking about the IPO on this and working out what number we might like and thinking, yeah, somewhere in the region of sort of 80. And it appeared at about 140 and thought, never mind, this is never getting to there. And it had a bit of it's been up and down along the way, effectively. It's not never quite been at the level where I've thought, I'll take it here. But the market does still, it's still a kind of youngish company, and I think markets tend to have strongish feelings about young companies, a bit like Progyny, actually, to be honest, when they're doing things that they like, very positive, when they feel like they're making some sort of misstep, as they were when they attempted a buyback not so many years ago. That was also received quite negatively for reasons that I thought were not particularly well justified. So I think there are probably better opportunities to come on. I don't know, but I wouldn't be amazed to hear there were better opportunities to come with this stock, I think.
Is it on your consider list, Steve? I imagine this has been on your consider list for a while.
It's not been on my consider list for a while because I've always lazily assumed it was overpriced. It probably should be on my consider list for a while. I hear in less and less about it, and less I hear, the more and more I kind of like it. I think I'm pretty clear on what the good things are about this business from a lot of different perspectives. And the more people are talking about those, the more they're likely bidding that stock up and making it harder to buy the thing at a price that I like. The more they're getting distracted elsewhere by more obvious AI beneficiaries, call them that, the better I think the kind of I like my chances in things that are perfectly good, just not kind of in as fashionable at the moment, I guess. People aren't really bearish on Airbnb, I don't think, but they're sometimes more enthusiastic than they are now.
I think it's my, just on a personal note, I think it's the first place I look now when I go for, think about going on holiday. or going away anyway. It's the first place I look for anything, so I would assume it is for quite a few people. I mean, I do hear the bearish sentiment on it. There are people who have had negative experiences, and they somehow think that's an Airbnb issue when, you know, Airbnb will do its best to root out bad hosts, and they will only be able to bad host a few times before they won't be able to host. So unfortunately, negative experiences are part and parcel of it. It's like people who have never been on a holiday and got a half-built hotel in Greece, which, you know, the Holidays from Hell segment on that used to be on TV when I used to get home from work when I was younger. That was always pretty entertaining. But yeah, I think there's a sort of an opinion of Airbnb that people are stretching a little bit too wide in that regard. I think it's a fine business that just keeps churning out the results, and it's actually quite lean and efficient as well. That we've said it a number of times, but COVID really, really taught them a lesson. They lost so much money during COVID. They learned that to come out of the blocks and be a successful public company, they needed to be lean and efficient, and they've done all of those things. And I think from here, Steve, this only continues. And it is on my list of things to buy again, I think. I'll just need to try and get some cash together and, see where we go from there.
Getting lean and efficient is on my list of things to achieve this year. It seems highly unlikely. I'll settle for surrounding myself with beauty in the meantime. But thank you all very much for listening. That's been our show. We'll be back next week with more things to talk about from what's been happening in the markets. But for now, I've been Steve. I've been joined by Steve. Thank you all very much for listening. Check us out on our podcast feed, and do check out our affiliates and sponsors, which are Trading212 and finchat.io. Links are down below. We will see you next week.